A 1958 photo of a group of children in swimsuits standing with their backs to the camera on the shore of a polluted Lake Washington might be one of the most iconic images in Northwest history, and our resident historian Felix Bunnell is here to explain all about it. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, so we're on the cusp of summer, and it might be a fairly normal swimming season on Lake Washington, where lifeguards will be on duty at many city beaches beginning a week from Friday. Now, back in the 1950s, post-war suburban growth around the lake had outstripped the infrastructure, and Lake Washington had become a polluted open sewer. A young civic leader named Jim Ellis led a campaign to create a countywide agency to clean up the lake by building a new regional sewer system. Now, this required a public vote to create the Metropolitan Council, or Metro, and that was the first step. Now, in March 1958, that measure failed, but it went back to the ballot for September 9th, 1958, and for that second try, a poster was created, and I have a picture of it on my Twitter feed. The poster features an iconic photo, five kids in swimsuits. There's a sign that says, "Warning, polluted water unsafe for bathing." Now, one of those kids, the little guy in the middle, was Keenan Block. He's a former journalist and longtime public affairs guy. I met up with him recently at Matthews Beach.
So my sort of extraordinary and very minor claim to fame is I'm a native Seattleite, and when I was 4 years old, back in 1958, my parents dragged me and my siblings to Lake Washington to be in a photo shoot for the Metro campaign, which was a campaign to clean up Lake Washington. We were dumping raw sewage into it back in those days, and it was an effort to get the voters to pay for sewage treatment. And our scrawny little butts were looking out over a polluted lake and a sign that said, "Warning, no swimming, polluted water." And the poster that became rather classic said in huge letters, "Emergency, clean up our filthy lake."
So if you're following along at home, Keenan's in the middle, his late sister Susanna's on the left, his brother comes next, there's Daniel Keenan's right, and his late brother Adam on the far right. Now, it was no random occurrence the Block family was featured in the iconic photo and poster.
The reason us Block kids got roped into it is my parents were political activists and social do-gooders, and the folks involved in the Metro campaign had tried earlier to pass this referendum unsuccessfully, and they were sort of baffled that, you know, going around with public health officials and doctors saying it's really not good to have raw sewage being spewed into the lake, and it still failed. So they realized their mistake was going after folks' heads, not their hearts. Said, "We need some kids who can't swim, and don't Bob and Dorothy Block have a slew of them?" So they called my parents up, and they got all of us to get in our bathing suits and drove us here to Matthews Beach and took the photo that became that iconic Metro poster, and it passed.
Now, I don't know who did the graphic design for the poster, but the picture was taken by a photographer named Howard Staples. He began his career in Los Angeles in the 1930s and came to Seattle around 1940 or so to work for the old Seattle Post-Intelligencer. A lot of his journalism photos are in the collection of the Museum of History and Industry. He passed away back in 1996. Now, a longtime photography curator at MOHI's, Howard Giske, he's retired, but he's still an expert on Seattle area photography going way back. He knows Howard Staples' work, and he knows this photo, and he puts it in the top tier of recognizable local images.
Well, I think it was an early, really good example of photo activism, if you will. This was a news photographer, working news photographer, who was probably doing this work as a favor to the political campaign, and it was a brilliant photograph. How in the world are you going to document the need for cleaning up sewage in a beautiful lake without people? And he picked just the right people to do the picture, great landscape of the lake itself, and children, innocent children, children that want to go swimming, and that picture just did the job.
And it's really hard to point to an image that even comes close as a second in terms of being recognizable and having made a difference in something like a political campaign. Now, I met Howard Staples several times when I was a teenager back in the 80s. I was too dumb to ask any questions about the photo, but he was like this guy from another time. He was sort of dapper and fastidious, sort of reserved and serious, kind of like a literally from another time. I reached out to his granddaughter, Tenny Preby, who works as an executive producer at a Seattle creative agency. You know, details about how her grandfather came to be the one to take that photo are not really clear. But he definitely was part of the social circles that would have put him in contact with the Block family, with the Metro people, with Jim Ellis. And Tenny confirmed my visual recollections of her grandfather.
He's a very stylish man. You know, he always was wearing like lightweight wool pants and a really nice sweater. You know, he had this great mustache and those sort of artsy 50s and 60s glasses that he would wear. And I kind of actually have taken to wearing those. But now they would be considered that sort of ubiquitous creative director glasses.
So I guess it sort of runs in the family with Howard Staples' granddaughter. Now, details are scant for so many of the classic images from that era of photojournalism, you know, when it was the 1930s to the 1960s. The newspapers weren't exactly crediting photographers very well. It didn't really start till the 1960s. So many of the great images from the Depression, from World War II, from the post-war period, we don't know who shot those images. Now, I wasn't able to track it down, but Keenan Block told me about one more iconic image from the Metro campaign of 1958.
They used to have something called the picture page, as you may recall, in the paper, and it was like page 3, and it was 4 or 5 large images. After it passed, the next morning, the PI sent a photographer to our house, and they had all of us kids in our pajamas with our bathing suits in hand, sort of in the living room, waving our bathing suits joyously.
I'd love to see that. If someone has that lying around. Now, you know, Metro eventually took over the old Seattle transit system back in the 70s, and the whole thing was folded into King County government back in the 1990s. So it really was a monumental vote, that September 9th, 1958 vote. Now, Jim Ellis, he passed away not too long ago, back in 2019 at age 98. Metro was just really his first step. He led the forward thrust effort to create all that infrastructure and buy all those parks, build the Kingdome, and he led the Mountains to Sound Greenway, which recently became a national heritage area. So a guy who never held elective office but did so much stuff to create the world we live in now. But it all began with a photo of some kids who wanted to swim in Lake Washington. Yeah.
And can you imagine if they hadn't done that, what Lake Washington would be like today?
God, we'd regret it every day. Yeah, no, it's a wonderful thing that happened, what is that, 64 years ago? Yeah.
Think about it every time you pay your sewer bill, right?
Yeah, what a bargain. Bargain at twice the price.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at mynorthwest.com. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. King County Councilmember Dave Upthegrove is proposing to study the idea of a universal basic income, which we've discussed before. It's been tried in a number of other countries. Tacoma is trying it. I want to find out how he thinks this might succeed in King County. So, Councilmember Upthegrove, first of all, what made you decide this was the moment to try this?
You know, coming out of COVID, as the pandemic is getting behind us, I think it really shined a light on the disparities we have in our society. We've known they've been there, the growing gap between the haves and the have-nots, the loss of a middle class. And, you know, it just kind of a common understanding that something about our whole social and economic system isn't working well right now. And now is the time to explore strategies to try to forgive the cliche, but build back better.
I heard.
So, you know, and local governments are the laboratories of democracy. And this is something that people are kicking around in other jurisdictions. So I thought, why not take a look at it?
Okay. So how would King County's version work?
I don't know. That's the whole idea of doing some analysis and development of recommendations. I'm not even an expert per se on the topic. It's something that big picture wise holds a little bit of intellectual interest. And there's a lot of ways that jurisdictions can design a program. And that's the whole idea of taking our time and doing a study and some analysis and development of recommendations. I imagine if the analysis looks promising that we might consider a pilot project, but one step at a time.
Right. The original version was, and I'm talking about the ones that were tried, I think these were in African villages, basically, was that rich or poor, you got a stipend. So it wasn't income dependent. Everybody just had this minimum stipend to spend however they wanted. And that seemed to me to be the hang up to transplanting something like that to America, because here we rebel at the idea of just handing out money and letting you spend it on whatever you want. I mean, you have to, in your mind, at least have some inkling as to how to address that objection.
Yes, I think one option is to essentially means test it. It also is a way to control cost. And one way to design a program is to have an eligibility threshold that essentially a guaranteed basic income that if you aren't making income at a certain level, then you get some base financial support.
Well, that's the negative income tax, right? That's what the income tax was supposed to do.
Yeah, in essence, it's also, you could say it's a fancy version of the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the kinds of policy choices. You know, do you do it by family or by individual? Is it for everyone regardless of income, or is it for folks below a certain income?
But if it's mean tested, you're back to just the traditional welfare program, aren't you?
Not necessarily. We don't have a negative income tax right now. The closest we have is earned income tax credit. It philosophically might be something people are more willing to support. You know, if you look at the pros and cons, one of the downsides, some people argue, is that, you know, you're taking resources from everyone. You know, in essence, people who are low income may end up paying to help subsidize people who are well off. Or does Bill Gates need a check?
Well, it strikes me as the amount of money we are spending now trying to solve problems like homelessness, I mean, it's getting stratospheric. So what would be the minimum acceptable result for a universal basic income program? Because it seems to me that these days in King County, unless it gets rid of the tents, I don't think people are going to support it.
I think what we've seen from some studies in other areas that should be outcomes we would look for would be a significant reduction, if not elimination, in poverty, an increase in economic mobility. I think there's absolutely no doubt something like this works best on the national level. I think this would be very difficult at a local level. Part of my motivation is to spur a discussion, kind of like we're having now, and to draw attention to bigger ideas. But I think at the end of the day, this is the kind of, if this were a program that ends up making sense, that it would work best at a national or at least state level.
Yeah,
I think it's the opportunity we have at the local level is to do some of the analysis, maybe try a pilot, see what we learn from it, see what works, what doesn't work. But I just think fundamentally things need to change right now, that the status quo isn't enough.
So what's your timeline? Have you made a formal proposal to do this?
Yeah, and it sounds like I've gotten positive feedback. We have a supplemental budget coming up in the next month here, and I've made a request to the budget chair, and she indicated a willingness to include it in her version of the budget so that I won't need to offer a separate standalone amendment. So I'm very optimistic it'll be in the chair, as you call it, the chair's budget, mm-hmm. and then hopefully get something back by the end of the year.
Dave Up the Grove, who represents South King County on the King County Council. Dave, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for the interest.
And with most states reopened, Washington not far behind, things are looking up these days. Still, there are some experts concerned about a perfect COVID storm that could have long-lasting implications. And with that story, here is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
That perfect storm, the return of near-normal behavior, the leveling off of people getting vaccinated, and the new Delta variant.
The Delta variant should be that warning flag of, hey, we don't want this to get any worse.
Tacoma ER doc and State Medical Association President Dr. Nathan Schlicker explains.
We're seeing that it's about 85% effective, the vaccines against Delta, at preventing disease. About 95% against hospitalization. But, you know, 85% means that 15%, about 1 in 7, can still get the disease. About 1 in 20 could still be hospitalized despite being vaccinated. And so that's the Delta variant. If we continue to allow it to evolve in the community, if we continue to allow mutation to occur because we're not getting it vaccinated, we're not getting vaccinated, and we're not curbing the disease, then we're potentially going to have new variants that could cause us more problems.
The bottom line for him,
the vaccine is good. You know, it is. A couple of key things the vaccine does. One, it protects us from the disease and keeps us open and our communities open. But two, it prevents the virus from circulating in the community to create new mutations.
Governor Inslee says our vaccination rate was just over 67% as of yesterday. Dr. Schlicker says the concern is
we have seen vaccine, you know, delivery rates drop off. We're making progress, you know, about 30,000 doses a day in the state, but we could be doing more. Right now, it is not a problem of supply of vaccine like in the early days. This is that time where if you want a shot, you can get a shot, truly applies. So if this that thing has been on your list that you say, hey, I'll get around to it, but I got bills to pay, groceries to pick up, 1,000 other things to do. Well, take the time, make it the priority now, because we need to get this done to, you know, help protect our communities and each other.
And he says what people should understand.
Delta variant is about 85% protective if you with the Pfizer and some of the other vaccines after the second dose. Unlike the Alpha variant that we had a decent amount of protection after the first dose, the Delta variant is not seeing that protection, is similarly occurring with the first dose. So it's even twice as important now to get vaccinated and get it started. And if you're one of those ones that got your first dose and hasn't gotten the second, because again, it wasn't a priority, get in and get that second dose. Bring your immunity from 40% to 90% against the Delta variant.
For those who worry about the safety of the vaccine,
what I tell them is that we had 20 years working with this technology of the mRNAs. And secondarily, we now have one of the largest studies in human history on the safety and efficacy of this vaccine. If you think about it, with a lot of cancer drugs, we're testing on 1,000 people or less, and we're approving them. We have hundreds of millions of doses delivered of this vaccine. When it comes to the safety profile of this medication, it is one of the best tested, best evaluated medications you will receive in your life. And I would bet you many of your friends have gotten medications that they've taken without a second thought. Or family members have that second thought that have a lot less safety research attached to them, but it's good science.
And if you're one of those who says you never get a flu shot and you're always just fine.
One, this is not the flu. And what we're seeing is that as this disease evolves and mutates, it's getting more and more virulent.
A lot of this comes down to the numbers.
50% more transmission with the Alpha variant. 50% more than that with the Delta variant. More hospitalizations. So it is continuing to evolve and adapt to the pressures that are applied to it. And death is easy when it comes to COVID. There are a lot of people living out there with long-term complications from this disease. Now, I've got friends that are in their 30s that have heart failure. They've gotten blood clots from it. They may not be able to return to the activities they love ever. You know, and so when we talk about it, people say, well, I'm not going to die. Well, that's not the only outcome that can impact your life. There are a lot of things. Chronic fatigue, pulmonary embolisms, heart disease, and lung damage that could forever change what you are enjoying as your healthy 20s and 30s and make your life a lot different, even if you survive. Quality of life, not just quantity of life, is a real issue for folks.
And here's the thing about the Delta variant.
So when we hear about India, you know, and what has just ravaged their country, that is the future we're trying to avoid here with vaccinations. It's much like the UK variant, the Alpha variant that ravaged the United Kingdom around Christmas and sent them back into lockdown. When that hit the US in March and April and into May, we had thankfully reached enough vaccination that we started to have a little bit of protection from it. And we went back up. There was no argument. Our cases spiked back up after February when we were kind of on that downslope. But we were able to weather that storm because of the vaccination rate and the protections we had. But again, Delta, you know, the India variant is much higher, much more transmissible. And as a result, you know, and much more likely to get you in the hospital. So again, yes, we're doing more and more vaccine and more protection, but the disease is getting smarter and more aggressive. And so it means we need to be more and more and more vaccinated to protect ourselves.
He's saying at this point, if you want a shot, you can get a shot. So people who are not getting the shot don't want the shot. And that's now their choice. What more can you say?
Just kind of what he did, that it's a poor choice and that it would be better for all if we got all of us vaccinated. I was talking to him. I have some friends who aren't vaccinated and have no intention of getting vaccinated. And their reasons are basically that they don't really feel like there's a need. They don't get sick. You know, they never get the flu shot, that kind of stuff. And that's kind of what he was addressing. He said those are kind of the main reasons. And people need to understand what we're dealing with is the evolvement, this disease evolving. And if we're not careful, he says, it's going to continue to evolve. And I don't know if you listen to the numbers he said there. He said the Alpha variant, so that was the first variant we had, was 50% more infectious than the original. And then the Delta is 50% more than that. And it goes on and so on and so on, kind of like exponential growth.
Oh, so
right?
is he then arguing, okay, because I've heard this argument too, that even though you're vaccinated, as long as there are unvaccinated people, the virus will continue to evolve in them until it is,
yes,
it is dangerous to defeat the vaccination?
Yes, absolutely. Because with the Delta variant, you're still protected with the vaccine, but you're not as protected as you were with regular COVID, right? It's he has the numbers there at the beginning. It's a certain percentage. I think it's 15%. Huh. I want to say it's 85% protected.
So the unvaccinated people may force us all to go back to wearing masks again?
Yes, and that's what he said. He said if this is allowed to evolve, and so it's allowed to evolve because there's still virus circulating in the community with, yeah, those people who are unvaccinated. And if it continues to evolve and we go above and beyond the Delta variant or even the Delta variant, you know, if you, anyone who saw what happened in India should be worried about that being here. And if it continues to evolve like that, he says we are absolutely, there's a real risk of going back to lockdown.
Yikes. Well, then I'm really glad I bought my backup masks.
There you go. Yeah. And he still wears his mask, he says, because he doesn't, there's this, you know, I think it's a 5% chance that you still get it.
Yeah.
And he says, I don't want it. So he doesn't go, he runs outside, doesn't go to the gym, and he wears a mask inside.
All right. Hannah Scott, thank you.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. Men and women who serve as police officers across the country are going the distance to help others. And nobody knows that better than CBS's Steve Harkin.
Police lines make headlines. The actions of some officers, front page fodder.
But there are other back page stories. Stories I have personally told over the years about officers who go above and beyond. And although these stories are far less touted, they are equally reflective of the men and women who serve.
A couple years ago, Officer Jeff Turney responded to a call in Glendale, Arizona.
Your family's concerned about you.
This 94-year-old man was about to drive himself 2,000 miles to Florida. Turney shut that down.
All right, you ready?
Yep.
Then took a week of vacation to see he got there safely.
You got her, buddy.
Then there's Brian Grigsby and Troy Dillard of Little Rock, Arkansas, who found an Alzheimer's patient out wandering.
See a white male by the name of Melvin Amrine.
I mean, he was pretty adamant.
He wasn't going home until he got those flowers.
Flowers?
That's what he wanted. He wanted flowers for his wife because tomorrow was Mother's Day.
So instead of driving the man right home, they took him to a shop and even helped pay.
We had to get those flowers. We had to get them. I didn't have a choice.
I also met Pittsburgh Detective Jack Mook, who came across two brothers at a boxing gym. Mook says they were being abused and neglected by their foster parents.
They have had it as worse as any other kid that's ever lived in the city of Pittsburgh, living conditions-wise.
Really?
And that just, I had enough of it.
So this bachelor cop adopted them.
You're Mook, right? You happy? Good.
And finally, Denver police officers Monique Sedberry and Alicia Martinez, who were called to a school one day.
This was one of the tougher calls, mm-hmm, for us. His teacher had called 911.
Saying?
Saying that he was being bullied and he wanted to end his life.
Not only did they help Victor Haran in that moment, they formed an everlasting bond.
So how often do you guys see each other?
Often.
Yeah. He's like our family. He's like our little brother.
Is it helpful to you that they've stayed in your life?
Yeah. Every time I wanted to talk to them, they would answer.
They'd be there?
Yeah.
This is what's possible when a police badge is worn over a loving heart. These are the results when officers choose to draw their most disarming weapon, compassion.
That is Steve Hartman.
Yep, it's important to tell those stories too. Mm-hmm. Here is G. Scott. It's Seahawks update time, or as I flubbed earlier, G-Hawks update time.
Hey, yeah. Good morning.
So the Hawks are at the VMAC, and so who's got the question mark next to their name?
Well, the question mark is this. We'll start off with Jamal Adams, the superstar that was traded for, came into the Seahawks last season, who played phenomenal. He was incredible for the Seahawks, probably one of the main reasons that they were 12-4 during the regular season, and one of the main reasons that they were so good, especially the second half of the season on defense. But he wasn't there. Now, according to Brady Henderson from ESPN, it has been said that the Seahawks did go ahead and excuse him from the mandatory. So right now it's mandatory for the Seahawks to be there in practice. And according to them, he has been excused. But one of the things that stood out right now is it was kind of thought that maybe that Jamal Adams would get extended, get another contract, considering that he came over and did so well. He's due to make $9 million, almost $10 million, $9.8 million to be exact, this upcoming season. But Jamal Adams, of course, playing the way that he did, being 26 years old, he's thinking, hey, it's time for a new deal. So Pete Carroll has said, with the Seahawks, he has said, you know, they haven't got a deal done, but they, you know, they are probably going to be working through it. There's no guarantee if it's going to happen by training camp. So that issue is going on. And then Dwayne Brown, who is the offensive lineman, left tackle, he was there, but he did not practice. And now come to find out, Dwayne Brown wants him some new money. Right now, he's due to make $13 million with his contract this upcoming season. But he is, of course, he's 36 years old, and he's looking for a new deal, considering this will probably be his last deal as he probably rides off into the sunset.
Does that ever work out for them? Do they ever get the money once camps start up?
I mean, some do, some don't, right? In this case, it just depends on who you are and what you mean to the team. It's no different than in real life. I mean, there's some folks in business like, you know, I'm not going to go for that pay. And then some employers say, you know what, we don't need you. And they don't. And in this case,
it's a gamble. So, would those players get picked up by somebody else this late in the game if the Seahawks were to say, nah,
well, here's the thing, Colleen. They're under contract. Right. Under contract. And so if you guys remember
the upper hand.
So let's go back years ago. You guys remember when Cam Chancellor was in the same situation?
Yes.
And the Seahawks was like, you're under contract. And then he sat out two games and then he ended up coming back. And then it was a whole kumbaya ceremony.
That's right.
So in this case, let me just say this. Here's my concern. I don't have concern for them. Business, totally understand. They have to try to make as much money as possible. That is just the name of the game. No, all respect to them. Okay. My concern is as a Seahawk fan, me personally, as a Seahawk fan going into this season, you almost feel like everything has to be firing on all cylinders. So I hope that when training camp comes, which is at the end of July, and it starts, I hope that everybody is just ready to go. I hope that there's no sitting out a contract. We just got through with the whole, okay, Russell Wilson, you good? Okay, Russell Wilson, the Seahawks, they're good and everything. So Dwayne Brown is the leader of that offensive line. What has been the conversation? What was Russell Wilson talking about recently about what was going on? He needed to be blocked for better, right? It was talking about the offensive line. So the offensive line needs to be solid with their leader in Dwayne Brown. That's number one. And number two, on the defensive side of things, when you talk about Jamal Adams, he was really big and he was good for the Seahawks. We need that guy ready to go as well.
All right. And we should also mention that the Mariners won 10-0 over the Twins last night.
Ooh. Championships!
So that's
championships!
Pretty good.
Pretty
good. So, huh?
G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G.
Thanks, guys. You can ring my
bell. Ring the bell. Whether you're ready to get out and explore Seattle on foot or you're content to just stay home and do your exploring virtually, Cairo Radio's Rachel Bell has a suggestion for your weekend plans.
The Washington State Jewish Historical Society just launched a virtual tour of Seattle's Central District, shining a light on the old Sephardic Jewish neighborhood.
This neighborhood was the center of Jewish life
from about the 1920s to the 1960s.
Coincidentally, the Black Heritage Society of Washington State also launched a virtual tour of the Central District.
This tour is for everyone, and Black history is everyone's history.
When the two organizations learned about each other's tours, they discovered some crossover.
It covers several of exactly the same spots because several of these buildings started as important buildings to the Jewish community, and then ultimately the Black community purchased or took over these buildings. So it's really cool to see how some of these buildings have evolved over the years.
That's Cynthia Flash Hemphill, a volunteer with Seattle Sephardic Network and the Jewish Historical Society.
We're standing in front of Washington Hall.
She says the Jewish community started using Washington Hall in the 19-teens.
For both religious services and then also for performances. They did original plays in Ladino, which is Judeo-Spanish.
Black Heritage Society President Stephanie Johnson Tolliver says Washington Hall has been an arts hub for Seattle's Black community for over 100 years.
Ella Fitzgerald was there, Cab Calloway, all of them up to Jimi Hendrix, all performed out of Washington Hall. Ray Charles was here really early on, and he performed actually at the YMCA that's right off of 23rd Avenue, mostly during the 40s. He was here.
He lived here.
For a short while, he did.
In the 1960s, the Sephardic Jewish community moved down to Seward Park, but the Central District was their first Seattle home.
The people who lived here during that time, they will talk about the Shabbat stroll, where you walked around the neighborhood, you knew everybody, you could go to anybody's house for lunch. It was a very contained little neighborhood where everybody was either related or they knew each other.
So when you say Shabbat stroll, for people who don't know, that's because you can't drive a car during the Sabbath, Friday night, Saturday morning. So people were just walking around the neighborhood.
Yeah. Plus, at that time, I'm not sure how many people had cars. It was the Depression.
The tour can be taken virtually from anywhere in the world. Or you can do a walking tour like Cynthia and I did, using the online map as a guide. When you get to a location, you can click on a video to hear a local person who lived in the neighborhood.
Candiotti's was the place to go. He had a soda fountain, which I couldn't, they didn't have the money for, but he had a ton of penny candy.
So where are we going now?
Now we're going to go to what is currently the Tolliver Temple, which is a Black church, but it used to be the Sephardic Bikur Holim, which is one of the Sephardic synagogues.
Sephardic Jews came from Spain and Turkey, and Seattle has the third largest population in the country. The Tolliver Temple has been a Black church since the 1960s, but it still looks like a synagogue.
There are Stars of David on the top of all the windows. And then there's also Stars of David on the doors entering the building.
Both tours also feature Garfield High School and the Douglas Truth Library.
Yes, my heart. I absolutely love that library, and that's a really great and rich history, too.
The Central District is like an old house, with layers and layers of culture, history, and communities stacked on top of each other like sheets of wallpaper.
We talk about the Central District being the home to African American community. It was also the home to a Jewish community, Danish community, Chinese, Japanese, and Filipino communities. So it was really a diverse community early.
To find links to both of these tours, go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
Great idea for spending the weekend. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.